Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Motorsport Podcast in association with Mercedes-Benz.
Some things are made to cope with puddles and rain. Others deal with the stickiest of mud. And as for the snow, that takes a warm coat and sure footing. But when it comes to dealing with all conditions, there's only one thing that springs to mind. Mercedes-Benz 4MATIC. All-wheel drive performance in any condition. So whatever the weather or road throws at you, you're ready. To see the 4MATIC range for yourself, visit your local Mercedes-Benz retailer.
I'm Ed Foster, and I'm joined by our Grand Prix editor, Mark Hughes, features editor, Simon Aaron, and the editor, Nick Trott. Our special guest today, Karine Chandhok, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. Eagle-eyed amongst you will notice, obviously, there's a certain F1 flavour to this podcast, and that's exactly what we're doing. We're going to preview the 2017 season. There's loads of changes. The cars are wider, the tyres are wider, it's more downforce, the tyres are supposed to last longer. We have two new drivers, there's no Nico Rosberg, there's a pink car, and the McLaren Honda doesn't work. We will delve into all of those, and we're also going to take lots of readers' questions. We have so many that we'll try and get through as many as possible, but there is absolutely no way, and even if we kept Karine and Mark here for 4 hours, would we get through all of them. So, Mark, I'm going to come to you first and just ask, what are the fundamental changes this season to the cars? What's happened to the rules?
A lot wider bodywork, bigger wings, bigger tyres. And about 35 to 40% more downforce.
And they are faster, looking at testing.
Faster, about 3.5 seconds so far. But I think when you see it run for run comparison, it's probably going to be maybe 4.5. You would say that, but Barcelona, 4.5.
Yeah, I think if you look at, as Mark says, you have to look at it like for like. Testing last year was a 22.8, and this year we've seen an 18.6. So that's just over 4 seconds. I think till we get to qualifying, in Melbourne, we won't really know. But I think the other thing this year, which is going to be really exciting, is the rate of development. Because the teams, when you speak to the engineers and designers, you know, they feel they've just scratched the surface. They've all very much got a launch car, and then they've all had to make quite an aggressive plan for development through the year. So I strongly suspect the car in Abu Dhabi will be quite different to what we've seen.
Yeah, because it's so different. That whole box where you work in the aerodynamics is no, you're no longer just refining little bits. It's everything's open. So to try and get the ultimate, it's a much, much bigger formula to solve.
There's actually a question here somewhere about where the development is going to be. He's asking whether it's going to be the power unit or the aerodynamics. Hearing from that, it's the aerodynamics, isn't it?
I think it's both, because I think that token system, which most people seem to loathe, is now gone. So I think it's easy for all of us to focus on the aerodynamic side because it's what we can see physically. But I think equally the power unit side is going to be fascinating. I mean, Mark and I had plenty of conversations last year about all this different injection stuff and various things that people are trying. Renault were one who didn't really use that many tokens in the last couple of years. And I'd be interested to see, now that development is free, effectively, do they have the resources to throw at it in the way that Brixworth and Mercedes and Ferrari have done? And can they keep pushing on development? And that's even before we talk about Honda.
Yeah, well, we'll come to that. I think we're going to spend a large part of our time talking about McLaren Honda. But you've been to the test. Having spoken to the drivers, what are these cars like to drive? They are more physical,
I think. Yeah, no, unquestionably. It was interesting seeing a lot of the drivers had the, you know, I recognize the racing driver, my neck hurts, head twist, you know. You tap them on the head, say, oh, how are you doing? And they do this instead of that. So the whole body turns, and I was like, yeah, I recognize that. I've been there, which is great to see. And I think, you know, there's a certain sort of perverse pleasure in getting pain out of doing a physical workout or an exercise. You know, it's the same when you go cycling. You know, you want to feel that pain in your legs, and there's a sort of perverse pleasure you get out of it, and I think that was missing from racing drivers in the last few years. You know, I mean, I remember Malaysia 2010 when I finished the Grand Prix and I got to Parc Fermé. You know, you had Alonso, they all get on the weighing scale looking all, you know, fit and happy, go behind the banner boards in the FIA garage, and they're on the floor, and you know, Alonso and Kubica is there with a bag of ice on his head, and they're all drinking cans of Coke to get sugar. But they look spent, and that's, I think that was missing in the last few years because the race pace was so slow, and that should be different this year.
Jim, do you think that's going to make it a lot harder for a kid like Lance Stroll, for example, who we've seen drivers coming up from GP3 and things and immediately settling in and being able to drive, as you say, 4 seconds off the pace or whatever in a race? That's not going to be the case for Stroll, and it's a massive step for him from Formula 3.
I think any time you come into Formula 1, it's difficult. You know, if he'd come in the previous era doing what he would have had to do in terms of tyre management, would have been very different and very difficult. I mean, I had the chance to drive a Formula 3 car a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, I was doing long runs just to try and knock the rust off. And it's amazing, you had zero tyre dig. And you have to remember, that's what Lance has come from. So if he had got into last year's era of F1 cars, he would have perhaps suffered with that. So I think coming into F1, it should be difficult. Formula 1 is the pinnacle of the sport. It should be difficult. It shouldn't be easy for rookies to just get in and get on with it.
Mark, the cars are faster. They're more physical to drive. Are the fans actually going to notice from the side of the track, really, or, you know, from an average grandstand? Putting aside the Valencian grandstand where you couldn't even see the track, but from the average grandstand, are they going to see it?
If they'd gone last year and they'd come back this year, yeah, you notice the difference. They are visibly quicker. You probably wouldn't notice it on a TV screen because it tends to flatten everything out. But in isolation, they look much more dramatic. I mean, you're standing at the end of the straight at Barcelona, and you're seeing them come towards that first corner at 200 odd miles an hour, and they're well past the 50 metre mark. And you think, when's he going to break? When's he going to? And they just break and turn in, of course. And you think,
the wow factor is back.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It is. And you sort of go, whoa. And then you think back and you think, yeah, well, that's how they used to look before we had all this, you know, the subsequent, you know, the limitations. So, yeah, that's, they definitely do look better in isolation, but you quickly assimilate it, you quickly get used to it, just like the drivers will get used to driving them, your eye gets used to watching them.
Two questions. Have any of the teams in with your analysis so far actually showed their hand, delivered their true performance potential in testing? And when is D-Day for performance? Is it going to be Q2 in Australia? When are we actually going to see these guys going absolutely flat out and the engines turned up to the maximum?
Probably be Q3 actually, when they really let rip with the engine modes. You'll see the midfields at their ultimate in Q2. It's intriguing what we see in Barcelona. Cars, Ferrari and Mercedes ostensibly look very evenly matched, and certainly talking to some of the Mercedes guys, they think it's genuine. I mean, the Ferrari's was doing long runs quickly. It wasn't just that you think, well, all right, he's done a very quick three-lap run, but, you know how much fuel was in it? They do run different base weights, or traditionally they have. Ferrari traditionally run a lower base fuel weight than Mercedes. But on the long runs, that, you know, that wouldn't apply. So I think it's everything points to the fact that certainly a lot closer. Whether it's actually faster or not, we don't know, and I think it might be Q3 before we discover it.
Yeah, I think that there are two things that stood out for me. I spent most of the 2 days that I was out of the test walking around different corners, because you don't get to do that on race weekends. And, you know, I was at turn nine when Sebastian was on a medium tire long run and Bottas was on a soft tire. And like Mark says, I do think the Ferrari was a little bit lighter at that point. But at turn nine is a tremendous corner to see how a car's working. And the confidence that Seb had, you know, just half a lift and the speed he carried through the apex was very similar to Ricardo, who was, you know, on a, again, similar time. We know the Red Bull chassis is very good. But the Mercedes didn't look as comfortable through there. And coincidentally, on the flight home, I had the chance to chat with some Mercedes engineer, and they sort of agree. They say that, you know, in the high speed, looking at, don't forget, they've all got GPS data from the different cars they can look. And that seems to be a strength of the Ferrari at the moment, is in the high speed, the cars allowing the drivers to lean on it. And the other point to me, which was encouraging for Ferrari, was that they were able to swap to different tires and still be competitive. They were competitive across all the three tires that are really relevant. The Ultra Soft isn't relevant for Barcelona. But, you know, across the Super Soft, Soft and the Medium, they actually look competitive, which we've seen too many times, I think, last year, where you get to qualifying and they put a different compound of tire and they can't switch it on, they can't get a balance, something goes away. And instead of the front row, or maybe row two, they end up on row three. And I think that's a good sign for them.
Yeah, they had a very narrow window of balance last year. And even if the track temperature changed from Saturday morning to qualifying Saturday afternoon.
Like Mexico.
Yeah, it was finished. We'll see if that trait's still there, if we see some varying temperatures. But the first signs are very encouraging for Ferrari. I mean, the car looks like they've done something different as well. They've been adventurous aerodynamically. It's very different around the side pods to anybody else. It's got the high inlets. It's got the funny vanes ahead of it. So there's a lot of original thinking gone into it. So, you know, might just be that it's genuinely
fast. The packaging around the barge board side pod area particularly, I thought, is really impressive. I mean, it's not something you can just create or copy overnight either, because there's a lot of little bits that go together to make that. And that has a huge effect for the airflow on the rear of the car. And one thing that really stood out for me, when you stand at turn three at Barcelona, you see them sort of come past you all the way around one, two, and three. And Kimi was on a wider line, lap after lap, for whatever reason he chose that line. And you can actually see, you know, dust and marbles coming off the left-hand tires.
It was the same at 10. He wasn't making an apex at 10.
Yeah,
either.
He was so... But three is a high-speed corner. Yeah. But the rear of the car was planted. You know, he had his foot hard in. He was hard on the throttle. The rear of the car planted, and he still had the grip. And I thought, that's an impressive sign. You know, anybody else who was out there, you'd start to see a bit of movement. And to me, that was actually quite impressive to see.
We may need that more than ever this year. We may need drivers and cars to take alternative lines if what we're hearing about overtaking is going to be more difficult.
Aerodynamically, it's obviously... you've got shorter braking distances, basically, and you've still got the same trouble with the front wing, you know, through the preceding corner. Although one of the things that they think the lower wing should do is that it places the wake in a less damaging place for the following car. But I think that'll sort of even itself out. It'll be much of a muchness on in terms of that.
Slipstream should be more powerful, though.
Slipstream will be more powerful.
Because the drag is higher.
Yeah. But some corners that were brake are now just a lift. And so is that working against it? There'll be fewer marbles, so the line will stay wider for longer. But on the other hand, the cars themselves are wider. So I think it'll sort of balance itself out. I don't think there'll be a radical difference in the quality of the racing, but at least you know that what you're watching as the drivers, hopefully, is that the drivers going flat out, which you knew wasn't the case before.
Well, one of the big changes, obviously, the Pirelli tyres. Mark, you did a very interesting piece on the Motorsport website recently about what Pirelli has done to the tyres, but whilst they've stopped the sort of the rate of degradation, they haven't exactly improved things in terms of with a view to looking to exciting racing.
It's an improvement. It's definitely an improvement on what we had on the tyres that once you got them to too hot, they were finished. That's gone, and that's what they were primarily asked to stop doing. On the evidence of Barcelona, it looked as though they just on certainly on a medium tyre, there was no discernible deg at all. So that if that pattern holds, it would, yeah, you'd get a lot of one-stop races. There was signs on the some of the long runs on the soft tyre that there is some deg. It's a bit of a balancing act that Pirelli's got to pull off here. And I think on a relatively cool winter's day in Barcelona, it's probably not totally fair to try and transpose that on what we're going to see. But I'd say it's definitely better.
I think there's a couple of points. One is that they should really be aiming for a two-stop race to make the racing interesting. I think a one-stop is not going to be particularly interesting. But and I spoke to Mario Isola at Pirelli about that. And I said, what happens if we get to the first four races and we only see one stops? What, you know, will you have the flexibility to go down a range perhaps on the tyre compound further into the season? And he actually said they were quite open to the idea of sort of reevaluating things after the first three or four races and saying, you know what, we need to do something for the racing here and basically go one step down, which, you know, traditionally they've been quite conservative in their choice of compounds, haven't they, over the last 5-6 years?
But I think is a bit of a misconception about tyre deg. I think people think that tyre deg in itself is what was bad, and it wasn't. It was the type of deg that we had. It was the fact that
thermal deg.
Yeah, it was the fact that it was permanent. Even if we've had tyres in the past, proper racing tyres, where you can get heat deg, just they get too hot to be able to support the load. But you back off for a few corners and they come back. Well, these didn't, and that's what was bad. So it meant that the fastest way to drive a Grand Prix was to drive off the pace. And that's just fundamentally wrong. That's philosophically wrong. That's just wrong on so many levels. And that's what we've got rid of, so that's good.
So one of the big changes is Liberty Media. They've come and they're now owners. What can we expect from them this year in terms of changes? And I know just from going to the Barcelona test, one of the big changes, big for the teams anyway, the teams are allowed to share short videos on social media, which they weren't even allowed to film within 5 kilometres of the circuit, which, you know, as a team, you're putting all the money into this sport, yet you're not even allowed to share video on social media. It seems ridiculous, but that's obviously a small change. What can we expect from them?
Yeah, and I think that's a good first step. Personally, I don't think we're going to see anything change dramatically over the next couple of years. I think one of the key points, really, which Ross Brawn highlighted in a number of interviews I've seen, is that Formula One's been too reactive, and really what they need to be doing is looking down the line. What is the vision for the sport 2020 onwards? Because 2020 is a big year where, you know, the contracts with all the teams get renewed. There's a lot of stuff with different races. You know, the new Concorde Agreement or whatever it's going to be called at that point. And I think that's when we'll really see the true effect. Don't forget, there's a lot of long-term contracts already in place. So, yeah, we'll see some small changes here and there. I think they're more actively pushing the marketing and promotional side. I know they're recruiting very heavily on the in terms of personnel for the PR marketing side, which is what they need. But I don't think we're going to see revolutionary stuff in the next couple of years. And I think that's right. I think they need, rather than do knee-jerk changes, I think it's good to have a period of taking stock and then make a step-by-step research.
I'm really excited about that. Sorry. Any sport, in particular Formula One, is more enjoyable when you have a real passion for a team or a driver, and everything you do is about following that person or that team. And I think if you're discovering Formula One and have been over the last 5 years or so, you're probably going through all the teams going, well, who do I follow? You haven't really had enough media necessarily from the teams or the drivers themselves to actually really hook into someone. So I was really excited that Red Bull delivered a video that evening of the first test. I thought that was impressive. And equally, Ferrari seemed to have some kind of blackout, you know, in the first 2 days. And I was at Maranello during the test, and it was clear that was a strategy. Just don't tell anyone about it. But you know, in the restaurants and everything, all the everyone was going, why don't we know what's happening with Ferrari? What's happening with our team? You know, and of course, Red Bull have already produced a film. Yeah. That's brilliant for the fan.
Well, that's what the fans want. I mean, and I think I, you know, America knows how to do sport, don't they? They, and when you look at it, you know, and that's why, I'll be honest, I was a little bit disappointed that Haas weren't more NASCAR in their approach, and they ended up going more down the sort of Formula One route. You know, like in, you know, we should be able, if you look at a NASCAR race, you're, and there's a yellow with 10 laps to go, the TV people are there talking to a Stuart Haas engineer or the crew chief, as they call it, or even Gene Haas, on the wall, you know, as he's like, he pushes the headset back and he's talking to the TV guy and he's, you know, and I was hoping for a bit more of that. And I was hoping that they would rub off on everybody else. But in the end, they sort of went the F1 route of everybody else and having a PR man as a filter to everything and actually being quite closed off like everybody else. So I hope they change that.
Well, I mean, there are certain other aspects of the NASCAR model we could adopt, like more punch-ups in the pit lane afterwards.
Oh, the last week one was hilarious, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was
brilliant.
We got a question here from Nauman Mithani. What improvements do we want from Ross Brawn, Mark, in terms of short-term and then long-term as well? Because he is looking after the motorsport side of things.
Yeah, he's looking after the sport and technical sides. And on those, I don't think you're going to see any quick change, like as Karun was saying before, you're going to see a lot of stuff going on in the back, or you're not going to see it, it's going on in the background, where he's going to have a team of people around him researching how to get to where they want, and where they want to be is cars that are better to race, cars that excite the fans more, so that, you know, they've got better raw material to work with on a promotional side. I think you're going to... It's going to be an era compared to what we've had for the last 30 odd years. It's not going to be so openly confrontational. There's always going to be arguments and negotiations going on in the background, but the way of resolving those is going to be much less confrontational. And I think with Ross, there are three strands of the sport. There's the commercial rights holder, there's the FIA, and the teams. And traditionally, any two of those have been in dispute with each other at any given time. And that's just how it's worked. It's just the personalities involved. Now, Ross works for the commercial rights holder. He used to be a team boss, and he's got a very good relationship with the president of the FIA. So he is in a unique position, better than anybody in history has ever been, to pull those together, those three threads together as one. And I think he will do that. I think Ross is just someone calm, analytical, but with a, you know, core of steel. He'll just be like a tank going towards its target. You will get there.
I think for me the one of the big issues heading to 2020, and it's not again something that we resolved before, is how they can safeguard the future of teams and how we can get another team or two on the grid and not have this big disparity. And speaking privately to, I spoke to probably three different team bosses in Barcelona. And really the only way to do it is to tear up the existing model and start again. Whether they can or not is a different story.
But yeah, post-2020, that's what they will have to do. So then you get into a very difficult negotiation with principally Ferrari, whereby you say, look, we're going to redistribute the income.
Meritocratically.
Yeah, and then you're going to have a potential standoff, and that's going to be the big, I think,
and then Mercedes
two, three years down the line,
aren't they? Because so, Red Bull with two teams.
Yeah, I mean, and he's also, I mean, the other thing Ross is going to try and impose it, that he already said he would like to impose, is some level of cost cap. So again, you're going to have three teams saying absolutely not, and the other seven saying, yes, please, yes, please, yes, please. So how you resolve that as well. So, yeah, it's all nicey-nicey at the moment because it's new owners.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a nice reboot and all relationship.
It's kind of a honeymoon, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But there are some very, very difficult questions to be resolved.
But I have to say, and I've mentioned it in previous F1 preview podcasts, I would love to see some form of cost cap and greater technical freedom. I think it'd be brilliant.
I think that's something that Russ would like to see as well. Long term.
I struggle with the idea of how you'd police a cost.
Yeah, so do I. I have no idea how you do it, but
especially a Ferrari.
Or anyone. Or a company like Mercedes or Renault, who've got companies set up all around the world. How are you ever going to monitor all of that? Yeah. You know, it's just. I think the more interesting thing is to see, can you create a system where the cost-benefit ratio effectively becomes self-policing, meaning, you know, by spending an extra 100 million, if you're only going to find a tenth of a second, well, really, does that justify spending it? You know, and then it sort of becomes self-policing. That's the only way I can see it happening.
Well, maybe you say you can spend what you want, but once above a certain rate, it's 99% tax, and you give the other 99% to the other teams.
That'll be the Eddie Jordan model, then.
let's turn our focus to 2017. We've mentioned it. We've all had a bit of a...
What? We've been talking about 16 to now?
what we're about to talk about, we've obviously mentioned it. McLaren Honda. What has happened, Karin, and is there light at the end of the tunnel?
I'm struggling to see it in the same way that I think everyone in Barcelona and that garage is struggling to see it. I saw Fernando briefly on Friday. Was he driving the final day of the test? Yeah, it was Friday. And he just sort of shrugged and waved and said, sort of, I don't know what to say. And I was like, yep. there's a lot of shrugging the shoulders and rolling the eyes from the McLaren side of it, and a lot of stressed looking people from the Honda side. You know, we've done 8 days of testing, and the whole of the second week they couldn't do 11 laps in a row, which is less laps than they'd do in a qualifying session, let alone a Grand Prix, really.
Yeah, I mean, the secret of what's wrong is hidden deep within the internals of that engine. And so it's a fundamental problem, clearly, and it was only discovered, you know, when they got the car on the track. Although apparently it was problematical in a different way on the dyno, and they resolved some things on the dyno when something different came up when they ran it on the track. So, you know, it's just how long does it take to get that fix in place? We don't know, because obviously they're being very secretive about exactly what it is. It could be that, you know, within a couple of months they've found the magic thing that switches it all on and lets you run at full power, and it turns out it's okay. But that's, you know, the best possible outcome. The other one is it's just a fundamentally flawed engine, and we've got this whole season, a bit like, 2015.
Is it fair for McLaren to say it is all Honda's fault? But what is the McLaren chassis actually like?
It's too difficult.
Possibly,
you can't. It's running reduced. You know, reduced power. It's running hardly any laps.
It's hardly running.
Well, and all of it. You know, you listen to the gear shifts downside right. Every time I saw Fernando, you know, every time he does an upshift, there's such a cut in the gear cut on the torque curve. The rear of the car actually moves. They haven't had time to set up the electronics. The engine braking's not set up. The harvesting of the ERS affects the balance. And you know, you can't judge anything just with all the problems they've had.
Yeah, and once they've realised what they've got a serious problem, they will and decided to try and run it in sort of limp home mode, almost, which is effectively what they've had to do. Someone will have had to reconfigure a lot of software in a hurry, so I'm sure that's got a lot to do with why it suddenly stops on an outlap and brings the red flags out. So it just compounds and compounds.
And that really affects the motivation of people as well, from the McLaren side. You know, what is the motivation from the aero design chassis side for the guys to be looking for the extra half tenth when they're missing 2 seconds in another department?
You can imagine it just must be horribly frustrating. Must just be awful.
Okay, so you're Zach Brown. What do you do now? Do you very quietly in the background try and court another engine partner who's already in the sport, or do you stick with Honda?
In theory, and you would think there is capacity there for Mercedes to supply an engine on a customer basis. It's not no longer supplying Manor, and everything had been geared around doing that. It's been the best engine. We'll see if it still is, but it's certainly a competitive engine. I think if you're Zach Brown, you're probably having a very serious talk with your shareholders and saying, is this the time to pump some money in to invest in the team, to do something like that if it costs money to get it? I think it's something you've got to be considering in the background. As I say, it may be a short, quick, easy fix that just looked disastrous at the time and actually was just a hiccup. But if this is a real long-term problem and you don't have faith that it's going to change, then maybe it is time to start thinking that. You know, sort of like they did in 93, they were running Cosworths in between, manufacturer deals. They might have to think of something like that again.
I mean, the part that I don't get is that, you know, I go back to, let's say, the super successful McLaren Honda day of past, but they had a car out in Suzuka all the time with Alan McNish or Jonathan Palmer or Mark Blundell. Or, you know, these guys were pounding round and round and round. Forget the race drivers. And even in the next era, you know, I'm pretty sure Anthony Davidson was pounding around Suzuka in some form of test car. So you've got testing regulations, I get that. But Honda also own and supply half the grid of Super Formula cars.
And on the circuit.
And on the circuit. You know, the car produces a ton of downforce. I don't get why they haven't created this test mule that's just running nonstop. I mean, to me, that's a little bit of a sign of commitment to problem solve.
Just from the outside, it just looks a bit like an interesting little R&D project for some of the engineers, as opposed to a serious, you know, full on effort from a manufacturer.
Yeah. That's the thing.
It just has the look of a backed up R&D project, which is, it might be unfair. There might be hundreds of people that we don't see working absolutely flat out, but I do wonder how much commitment they're showing.
Does Honda still recycle its engineers on a regular basis like it used to?
Yeah.
So the lack of continuity.
But I mean, they had that system in place when they were winning.
But it's quite clear that, you know, when they, whatever they're seeing on the dyno is one thing, but it's quite clear that there's a lot of issues when you put the car on track and you've got all the stresses and the lateral loads and stuff. I mean, I think it's quite commonly known now that Mercedes invested heavily in the Super Dyno sort of facilities a few years ago, and that's paid dividends. But clearly there's issues when you put the car on track, and I don't get why they haven't got, you know, Matsushita or Jensen, who's around, just pounding around Suzuka every week for 2-3 days a week.
In a Super Formula car, you could
put all the loads through it. You could test a load of things. You could have two cars running all the time. If they were genuinely, I think.
Are you pitching for a job?
I was about to say, if Zach is listening, if you'd like Karine's contact details, do get in touch.
Yeah, but you know, I think that everybody's cut them quite a bit of slack in the last 2 years. You know, 2015, there was a lot of, it's their first year back, et cetera, et cetera. 2016, there were signs of improvement. So I think everyone sort of thought, okay, they're making progress. I'm not sure this year whether people will be as generous with sort of letting them off the hook.
Now, it's obviously, this all has a bearing on Alonso. We've got quite a lot of questions about Alonso. There's one here from Adrian King. With the ongoing McLaren problems, is there a strong possibility that Alonso will not see this year out? Anyone?
I think he'll stay in regardless, because you've got a very interesting time in the driver market coming up for next year. A lot of contracts are coming up for renewal. The whole market could be blown apart. I think you'd want to be around for that rather than you're going to be, if your current currency, you know, it's better than if you've been seen to have jacked it in halfway through the season.
So there's a question here from Lucio Chiodi, who is wondering where he's going to go. Really, Red Bull isn't really an option.
Probably not. They've got their own junior program.
And they've got three really good guys, and potentially if Kvyat gets sent together, a fourth as well.
You would think if they lose one of Ricciardo, Verstappen, it'll be Sainz that gets the nod. So no, I wouldn't have said Red Bull. Ferrari, going back to Ferrari, probably difficult on both sides. I wouldn't say impossible, but probably difficult.
He's back at McLaren now, I suppose. So.
Yeah, exactly. And if the car's a rocket ship, you know, it's amazing how quickly you can forget about all your previous history. So possibly. Mercedes, I don't know. I think there's generally a reluctance to put Hamilton and Alonso together from the team management, although it's what, you know, a lot of the fans would love to see. If Lewis decides to stop, who knows? I don't see that he is. I don't see any signs that he's thinking like that. But yeah, I mean, he would, I guess, be the obvious shoe-in for that.
I wonder if he has a shout of going back to Renault if Renault start to make the works. Renault team start to show signs of progress.
He could go back there anytime he wanted. Yeah.
No, so I mean, I wonder if that's a conversation that happens. Yeah. Later but this year.
The problem is anywhere he goes, the car will immediately be uncompetitive, won't it? I mean, it's can you think of another F1 driver from history who's as talented as Alonso, but has had such bad luck / made bad decisions in terms of team movements? Because everywhere he goes, the car doesn't perform.
Yeah, Chris Amon, similar. But a lot of it's, as you suggested, a lot of it was a lot of those problems were he made himself. So he set himself off on a course sort of in 2007, really, and it's still rebounding now. The run on from that is still playing out.
It still seems it seems remarkable that more than 10 years have passed since he won his second world title.
Well, it's the 10th anniversary of Hamilton coming into the sport, and that seems very recent as well.
So my theory, and it is theory, Lewis will go to Ferrari and he'll finish his career at Ferrari as Ayrton wanted to finish his career at Ferrari, and then Fernando will go to Mercedes, mainly because that'll be a great cover. But actually, wow, you know, and that, let's face it, that's not beyond the realms of possibility, is
but
it?
Things like that open up if the Ferrari's competitive. You know, a fascinating prospect for more reasons than just we're going to see better competition on the track. Suddenly the whole kaleidoscope of possibilities.
What if Kimi outqualifies Seb like he did last year? You know, what if Kimi suddenly emerges as the number one in Ferrari? Then what happens?
Well, Seb will go to McLaren.
As a loyal listener of the Motorsport Podcast, you can get 25% off the AMG basic training half-day course at Mercedes-Benz World. It's an action-packed, track-based experience with expert tuition, and the offer is valid until May 31st, 2017. Simply call Mercedes-Benz World on 0370 400 4000 and quote offer AMG25. For more information, go to www.mercedes-benzworld.co.uk. Karine, let's have a look at Hamilton and Bottas. Going to a new team, Mercedes Works team, having Hamilton as a teammate, has he made the right decision doing this 1 year deal? And is he really going to be able to be on a par with Hamilton at points?
Has he made the right decision? It's obviously yes.
You're
never, ever, ever going to say no to driving for the world championship favourite, irrespective of who's in the other car. I think we were talking about before whether drivers, and Nick asked the question, do teams show their hand until qualifying? I don't think drivers like Lewis or Kimi, for example, or Seb, show their hand fully until Q2 or Q3. I think they like, you know, Kimi famously used to do it to Montoya at McLaren. You know, he wouldn't show his hand till they got to qualifying, and then he'd blitz him in 2006. And that complete, you know, all of a sudden all the Latino toys had come out of the pram. And I think that's something that we're all thinking it. So I'm sure Valtteri is as well. I'm sure Valtteri is quite aware that this bloke's probably got 3 or 4 tenths in his hand when he needs it. I'll be interested to see how they get on. Honestly, it's impossible to judge from pre-season testing.
That's a curious dynamic there, isn't it? Because what do you do if you're Bottas? Do you play the same tactic, which it's potentially not going to be particularly revealing if you want to know how quick you can go in this car. Or do you just go absolutely flat out in testing?
I think Valtteri's priority of pre-season testing is really to understand the working method of the team, the language they speak, when they do a setup change, what does it do to the car, how do they deal with problem solving, a balance issue, how just understanding the systems. You know, we famously need to watch on board with Rosberg, or particularly Rosberg. You know, there's a lot of brake balance changes across the qualifying lap, you know, and that wasn't something you saw a lot of the other drivers doing. You know, you see the odd change, but not as much. You know, why was he doing that? Is that something I need to do in qualifying? And, you know, there's all that kind of stuff. And I think it's about doing the long runs and understanding how they communicate strategically, how they make, you know, changes to the strategy, things like that. Or what his test program isn't about looking for the last couple of tenths. It's about getting comfortable in the environment and trying to get up to speed with the car.
Q3 again, isn't it, then, in Australia?
I find it very hard to assess just how good Valtteri Bottas might or might not be. I mean, he was good in GP3, and he's looked decent with Williams, in his time with Williams, but there were times...
We'll find out in 2 weeks' time,
won't we? Well, we will, but it's very hard to know, to be sure, to have a clear picture, because, I mean, there were some times when he was plain blown off by Felipe Massa. Last year, not so much, but Massa was arguably beyond his sell-by date a little bit, maybe. But I just find his true potential very hard to assess. It just, you know, up and down performances. Sometimes excellent, sometimes barely visible.
Yeah, I mean, he'll have nowhere to hide in a Mercedes,
no. You
know, because even on a bad day, he should be qualifying in the top four, assuming Ferrari are where we think they're potentially going to be. Even on his worst day, he should be fourth. But, you know, he's up against the bloke who is... In every generation, there's been a super talent that's arrived. And Lewis undoubtedly is one of those. So this is where you'll get your answer.
In terms of competitiveness, though, anything less than slotting in where Nico left off, don't mean necessarily winning the championship, just in comparison and pace to Lewis, anything less than that, it's... Game over, isn't it? Surely.
Yeah, sure. And that's still one of the hottest seats on the grid, you know. Yeah.
And that means being within a tenth and a half most of the time, sometimes faster.
And you can be sure that people like Sainz and people like Alonso and Van Dorn. I mean, we're all talking about Alonso, but to me, Van Dorn is potentially the most talented rookie to have arrived into F1 since Hamilton. And... You know, what's he going to do? Surely that talent can't be wasted driving a car that, you know, that potentially can't finish the races. So, you'd imagine
Toto
he's on the phone.
Toto Wolff's a big fan as well.
Toto's a big fan. And you know, you'd imagine he's going to be on the phone fairly soon if, as Mark says, that scenario plays out where Valtteri isn't able to match what Nico did.
Well, there's going to be a lot of voicemails from Formula One drivers on Toto's phone, isn't there? Let's talk about Williams, where Bottas has come from. There's a question here from Wallace. He wants to know your take on Williams in 2017, especially with the arrival of Paddy Lowe. The Bottas deal, would that have ensured absolute parity on engine spec between the factory team and Williams?
I think they'll have... Their pace looks respectable, and they're not going to be challenging, you know, the works Mercedes, but they never have done. It looks a good, solid, consistent car from testing. It's probably got arguably the weakest driver lineup on the grid.
There is a question here from Ray asking whether it is the worst driver lineup.
Yeah, so I mean, Felipe's
that one.
Felipe, I think, was already past his best last year.
17.8 to Valtteri. 17.3, I think, to qualifying.
Yeah.
Last year.
Which, you know, was well down on his previous year's performances against Valtteri. So there were already suggestions there that his performance was tailing off last year. He's been pulled out of retirement to help a team out. So you've got to question what his level of commitment would be. I'm sure he's loving being back, because why wouldn't you? But I'd still say there's question marks about... you know, when you, how far on the edge do you put it? How, you know, just the little questions in the back of your mind. And Stroll, yeah, very, very inexperienced. He's had a few shunts in testing. I wouldn't necessarily say it's going to be a disaster for Stroll. He could get there in the end, but at the moment he's not at the level to come straight in. In the manner of, you know, some of the starring rookies of the we've seen of recent years, so we'll see. But they will get points. They'll look respectable at times, struggle at other times. I think it's a holding season for Williams, and planning for the future with Paddy joining.
maybe Alonso will go there.
Well, yeah, maybe. Yeah, exactly. And maybe, you know, with the Stroll investing, allowing more more of the programs to be switched on to properly take advantage of the team's facilities, because it's sort of in that awkward no man's land. It's not a big team. It's not a little compact Force India team either. But to properly access the potential of that probably needs a bit more investment. And that's, I guess, where Stroll comes in. And if that's being directed by Paddy long term, you'd say that's probably a very good plan.
What do you think they would have got for the Bottas deal? Because I'm sure they would have, they bargained quite heavily. Would they have got a lump sum, or would they have got more parity on the engine?
A lump sum, I understand. Quite a substantial one.
Oh, right. Well, that answers
it's
that
a public company. You'll find out fairly soon when you see the accounts.
A team we haven't really talked about, Red Bull, arguably one of the strongest driver lineups on the grid. Are Verstappen and Ricciardo going to be friends at the end of the season?
I think if they're not fighting for the world championship, yeah. I think the pressure of fighting for the world championship certainly will change that dynamic. But at the moment, they're fighting a common goal, which is trying to get the reliability up and therefore unlock the speed. Because unquestionably, as we've seen time and again in the last few years, the chassis is good. They haven't been able to unleash all of the power in the high power modes because they're struggling with reliability. Couple of things, though. When you look at the Red Bull, and I had quite a good look at it in the pit lane, they didn't seem to be massively keen to pull these screens all around the car as they had done in the past, and they sort of parked at the end of the pit lane quite happily.
Wonder if we see quite a different Red Bull in Melbourne.
Yeah, it doesn't look as complex as I would have expected. It doesn't look as complex as a Ferrari.
Around the bargeboard areas, it's all very plain, isn't
it?
Yeah,
exactly. And yeah. I think they've arrived at pre-season testing with a relatively low drag, aimed at lower drag than they would have liked, to see where they are in the lay of the land in terms of performance. And then I can see quite a big update package for Melbourne. And if not, certainly when we come back to Europe for Barcelona, I can see that's the team out of the top three. I can see having a very different car in 3 or 4 races time.
That's super exciting, isn't it? The fact that come Australia, or maybe, well, hopefully it's Australia, maybe it's Europe, but Red Bull will turn up and they'll be right there. And that's six cars. And that's six cars all fighting over the
last 10. Yeah, that's exactly what we want. Yeah.
Mark, can you explain to me what the difference is between a Renault engine and a Tag Heuer engine?
It's just the name.
It's just the name. And yeah. So Red Bull, have they been doing any development on their own with that?
No,
or is
no.
it literally just the name?
No,
so they are still using the engine power unit, which is, putting aside Honda, that is the weakest out there, would you say?
Well, last year it was probably third, but not that far off. They made big strides last year. It's probably a couple of tenths off last year.
Okay, so it's not too bad.
It wasn't a disaster last year, but it's a moving target. So you know, Ferrari have clearly made gains. Merck have probably made gains. We'll see what the Renault has. It's got new cylinder heads designed by Mario Alien.
He's now left.
He's
though,
left
he?
Now because he's right. completed the task.
Right.
So
they seem to be having ERS issues more than the actual ICE engine, didn't they?
Yeah.
MGUK sort of issues and
a lot of letters
with all three.
The joys of modern Formula One.
Oh, I know. Well,
what about the Renault Works team, Karin? They had a difficult season last year, but it's a case of rebuilding, isn't it? But they've done a little bit. But how hard is it as Renault to entice the big names and build up the team again?
Honestly, when you watch trackside, I was actually pleasantly surprised. I think actually the car looked a lot better than I expected it to. They're in the, you know, there's still a lot of stuff going on that needs to be shaken out. You know, obviously, they've lost Frédéric Vasseur, who I quite like. I think he's actually a really good guy and a true racer, and he's gone now as a team principal. Cyril seems to have sort of taken over that. Whether they'll replace Fred, we'll wait and see. I think Hülkenberg is a good addition. I think he's got a lot of experience now, and he'd be a good number one, good solid number one. The car, you know, looks like last year there were occasions like Azerbaijan, they were on the back row of the grid, and I'm sure it doesn't matter. You can come up with all the rebuilding stories in the world, but when the bosses show up from the Renault boardroom, they would not have been impressed seeing that. This year, they look like they moved themselves out of that pack and into that midfield, Force India, Williams, Haas, potentially, Toro Rosso fight. So I think there's actually five teams in that bunch. Williams may be at the head of the bunch, but certainly there's four just behind them. So I think it's good progress. But they, you know, at their lowest point when they took over the team, they were down to 435 people, I believe. And at its peak, Enstone was sort of 650. I believe that now in March they'd be back up to sort of 560 or so. So that's quite a big step forward from where they were, you know, this time last year in terms of just number of people working on the chassis side.
And what of Force India, Mark? Putting aside the colour, they are sort of known as the team with the biggest bang for its buck in terms of what they spend and the success.
Yeah, I was very impressed at the launch when Vijay Mallya is batting away Renault's claims that the works teams will just disappear from the independents in this formula because they've got so much more facilities and the integration of the power unit and the chassis would be. He batted that away and said, "I see no reason why we can't go one better and be third this year." I think that's that's painting it pink, but you know, don't count them out. They're for the size of team, they do a remarkable job, and it's just very, very well managed, well tailored team. The hard points are that right. Okay, we're not doing it our own wind tunnel. We're going to use a Toyota wind tunnel, which has had, you know, one of the millions and millions spent on it. It's a fantastic tunnel. It's everybody uses it pretty much. Okay, we're not even going to do our own gearboxes. We'll just take the Merc 1. The Merc 1 works. We know that works. We put that in with the Merc engine. So all those things, they don't have, you know, ambitions above the station. They just say, right, these are the hard points. This is how much money we have. This is how we're going to do it. And they just manage it very, very well. And they've got a great technical, you know, leader in Andy Green. And he just, they've just got that down pat, how to utilize what they've got very, very, very well. But that's never going to be, you know, unless you have a radical change of regulations, that's never going to be a team that is going to be able to take on the works teams. But it's, you know, it's done what it's done. It's fourth last year. It's been fifth. That's just what it does. It's very good.
But importantly, I think they're actually a good case study in from a financial standpoint. They're a self-sufficient team now.
Yeah.
You know, they finish fourth. They get X amount of money from FOM. They get X amount of money from driver sponsorship through Perez and now a bit of other sponsorship through. And it's a self funded team capable.
So all everybody has to do is finish fourth and then everybody's fine.
Yes. Basically. But also, you know, it sounds easy to say, but actually to use that amount of money they've got, and I think Mark raised a really good point, which is I think Andy Green is actually quite underrated. I'm surprised, for example, that people like Ferrari haven't tried to hit on him. Maybe they have, but I'm surprised people like Ferrari haven't tried to chase him down when they lost James Allison or even McLaren and people like that, because I think he's really, really good at delivering.
Well, he was briefly at Red Bull, wasn't he?
He was, yeah.
But it's quite nice because, I mean, Andy Green goes back to the days when Force India was the Jordan F3000 team, so he was a race engineer there, so he's,
Karim, what about Sauber? Is there light at the end of the tunnel for them? Because they've had a very tough time over the last few years. I guess budgets and money is always the bottom line, but this is going to sound ruder than it's meant to, but what's the point for Sauber? You've got to ask, haven't you? Because it's, you know, because I'm sure they can't be making the finances work.
Well, they've obviously got that investment come through from last I think it was early last year, wasn't it? The Longbow investment came through. Middle of the season, and that's sort of safeguarded their immediate future. You know, getting ahead of Manor last year helped for another chunk of money. But you're right, you know, you look at the car, and actually aesthetically, I quite like the car. I think it actually looks like quite a nice car, and they've actually, there's quite good detail work on it. You know, they've obviously put a lot of effort into it. But then when you look at the actual livery, there's not many sponsors on it. So that's quite hard. I'm sure there's a bit of money from Mercedes or Verlaine, and obviously we know about Ericsson, but it's tough for them from a financial standpoint. And also now, I suppose with Renault having moved forward, who are they competing against? I guess McLaren is
well, all they need to do is do more than 11 laps and they've got them beat. So,
And I think that's a slightly tricky thing, is unless they find the next greatest and don't forget they were the year-old engine, so start of the season they'll be fine. As the season goes on, that will suffer as the engine development moves on. They will perhaps, I suspect, aim for their traditional path of let's go for mega reliability at the start, try and pick up the odd points, which could happen. They were actually really reliable in pre-season testing, so they'll sort of go for that case model, I'd imagine.
Right, we've got about 5 minutes left, so I wanted to take as many readers' questions as possible and also try and get everyone's thoughts on who they think is going to win this year's championship. There's a question here from Kevin, who's based in Indonesia. Worldwide podcast, this. Mark, there's several drivers who claim this year's car will serve their style better. I'm wondering, seen from trackside, is the difference between styles very apparent, or are there any drivers who are going to have to change their style?
You can see the drivers carrying more speed in and being more aggressive in combined braking and lateral. So for somebody like Fernando, that will be very good. Yes, you can see it more. Whereas before, everybody was sort of held back to the same false ceiling. Certainly in the race, there were. I think everybody's good enough on there to be able to assess what the tyre needs and adapt the driving style. I don't think it's that it's going to penalise or reward one more than the other, but you will see differences in style more easily on these tyres than on what we had before, yeah.
Corinne, one here from Sam Smith. What do you think of the proposed wet starts? First of all, what are they? And what are the proposed starts, and what do you think?
Well, I think it's just not just for wet starts, but I think anytime we see a safety car, I believe they'd come back to the grid lineup and they'll see another start, which would be entertaining for the fans. Yeah. I think there's still a few question marks over how exactly it's going to pan out in terms of actual procedure and how practically it's going to work. But there are some changes. You know, for example, a car who starts in the pit lane, for example, you know, the safety car laps actually at the start of the race no longer count, from what I understand. So they'll do the laps and the safety car, it doesn't actually count towards a Grand Prix. They come back onto the grid to do the standing start. At that point, the guy comes to the pit lane. So we'll see some changes. It could mean potentially more incidents. It could mean opportunities to jumble up the order. I mean, races like Melbourne, pretty much guaranteed a safety car, aren't we, every year? Yep. So I think we should get a fairly quick look at how it works quite soon into the season.
So, Corinne, I know you've got strong thoughts on sort of huge runoff and, huge tarmac runoff. Yeah, exactly. So that's why I'm going to come to you for this question. This is actually one from Naaman, who we took a question from earlier. He's basically, this is sort of quite a long question, but he's just asking, is there no one else apart from Herman Tilke in terms of designing tracks? Because he says that a lot of the tracks he's designed aren't producing exciting racing. So there's that question. And the second part is from Ray, and he's asking about the endless runoffs and is this ever going to change? It seems like a driver can go off the circuit, rejoin, lose no time, and then finish a Grand Prix and be told that he had a wonderful drive.
Yeah, I mean, the first question, there are other people who design circuits. I mean, Alex Wirtz runs a company that does it. There's a guy called Clive Bowen who runs a company called Apex. They did Dubai and China, a couple others. So there are other people out there. You know, Tilke has obviously monopolized in many ways the F1 market, I think, for recent circuits. It's a very simplistic thing to do, to blame Tilke and his people for what's going on. Circuits are designed in conjunction with the FIA and the FIA safety department and the circuits commission. So there's a lot of committees and commissions involved with these decision-making processes. For example, a circuit like Le Mans, every year we go back to Le Mans, we see more and more tarmac runoffs and more tarmac put down. And that's got nothing to do with Tilke.
Circuit of America is a Tilke, isn't it?
Sorry?
Circuit of America, that's Tilke, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
That's a great circuit.
It's a great circuit, yeah. But I mean, it's got lots of tarmac runoffs, but yeah, it's a great circuit. And Sepang, I think Sepang's actually a great circuit to drive on. Yeah. You get great racing and there's something for the drivers. So it's easy to knock him. But I don't know what the answer is, to be honest, and why we seem to be going a long way down this path of tarmac runoffs. And then it just adds complication. You know, we try and find this a high curb, or we try and find AstroTurf. You know, I don't know how many more times I've got to say, I don't see what's wrong with real grass and real gravel. You know, there's a lot of complications with the bikes as well, because, you know, the FIM have their own safety norms for the same circuits. But surely you can put 6 meters of grass and gravel and then have 10 kilometers of tarmac, and it'll stop a lot of what we're seeing of people corner cutting and putting wheels off track.
The basic ones in terms of bikes versus cars is the bikes want the kitty litter, and then the cars want tarmac. So it's a sort of constant battle. But Silverstone manages, just about.
Yeah, but you still have, you know, the Exeter Club, Exeter Cops, you know, the constant arguments about, oh, do we have 6 inches of the wheel over the white line? You know, I hate having those arguments. You know, it's like we should be, when qualifying's over, we should be looking at the sector times and the lap time. We shouldn't immediately be wondering, are they going to show us a replay of a guy with half a wheel over the white line of Cops? You know, the result should be the result.
The key there is not to have Vettel behind you, who is then constantly radioing in saying that Fernando's gone over the white line again.
Yeah. Right. I fear for a kind of a rule or something being dreamt up where a time penalty is imposed on the car during its next lap. So, you know, it's only allowed to use 3/4 of its performance or something like that. It's where maybe the new era of the sport that we've been discussing, the Liberty era, you know, we have to kind of monitor that closely, because I can imagine it'd be relatively straightforward to...
Yeah, I mean, I think that'll be slightly outside their scope. I mean, these track limits things deserve its own podcast, I think, but we could go on for ages. But, you know, fundamentally, the other issue is the inconsistency. You know, how do we choose some corners? We just turn a blind eye, and other corners we police, and, you know, all of this stuff. Let's just figure out a way to get real grass and real gravel and real deterrence. Actually, Paul Ricard's a good example, because that's tarmac runoffs everywhere. But the way they've done the negative curbs and the step on the curb means that in a lot of places, by actually going beyond the curb, you know, beyond the white line, you lose performance because the plank of the car hits the floor and you scrub speed. So, you know, there are solutions around the world. We just need to find them and then make it consistently implemented.
I just think we have to have Suzuka in every country, surely.
But even that's got more tarmac. Look at Turn 1, look at Degner, they're putting more tarmac there as well.
But I remember in 2009 when we went back to Suzuka after a couple of years at Fuji, all the 11-year-old Toro Rosso drivers were crashing during qualifying, and everyone was all the indignant. Oh, someone said to Kimi, do you think it's ridiculous that we race at a circuit like this? And Kimi said, no, absolutely not. You should be punished for making mistakes. It's the most animated I've ever seen him, actually. Yeah. And it was good to hear.
Well, like, to me, Spa's ruined. You know, with all the tarmac we have around Spa, it has actually been ruined. It's no longer the challenge that it should be and it used to be.
I feel as I've opened a can of worms here. Never thought about doing the TT, the Isle of Man TT. There's no runoff there. I think you'd probably quite enjoy that.
Well, or Goodwood. I love going to Goodwood every year. Yeah. I mean, I said to Williams, we ought to, you know, with the heritage stuff, we ought to try and see if we could run a car on there. But I think Johnny Williams got a little bit twitchy at that point. The prospect of a 14B thrashed around Goodwood.
Blimey. I'd pay to see that. Right. Looking for one name. Who would you put money behind this season?
I'll take money out of it, because the answer I would say is Hamilton, but that'll be a rubbish bet, because he's obviously going to be the favourite. My hope is that it's going to be much closer, and it could be Vettel or, you know, Kimi or whatever. But if I had to put my life on it, I'd say Hamilton.
Okay, so three names. It didn't give Toivonen, though, so improvement.
Yeah, well, you didn't mention Tot, so...
Simon.
Well, he's just nicked my answer, because logic suggests Lewis Hamilton. If I was actually putting money on it, I'd probably put a each way flutter on the two Ferrari drivers.
Right. Nick?
I guess I'm always looking for a story. Who do I think is going to win? Lewis? I think he'll win. I would like to see Kimi or Verstappen win for the story.
I concur. I mean, I think Lewis is the obvious one, but I've actually bet. I got 6-1 on Vettel for the championship, and I got 12-1 on Kimi for Melbourne. So I think that's quite a good bet.
That's very good. He's done 8-1 today.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see.
Ed, come on. And yourself.
I would like to see Ricciardo fighting probably for a world championship, because I think he's not necessarily an underrated driver, because I think people do rate him, but I'd like to see him get more success. He's a kind of guy that is good for Formula One. He's different from a lot of Formula One drivers. He's engages with people, I think, on a better level. So there we go.
Okay, one crazy bet then. I've got a bet that Force India will win a race this year.
I'll take that.
Yeah, so I need another crazy bet from
McLaren
you guys
to finish on the podium. This is never going to happen, is it? You get
Force India to win a race. Yeah. McLaren on the podium.
If it's a simple fix, as Mark suggests, there's a small percentage it could be, small percentage chance. If I lose the money, Mark, I'll come and find you.
Van Dorn, I'd qualify Alonso over the season.
Karun.
Karun to replace Massa.
I think mine will be Karun to spend most of the year at Suzuka driving around in a super formula car with a Honda hybrid engine.
Or a TT.
I hope that bet comes through. Well, go on. Is that actually going to be your bet?
Yeah, that's my bet.
Wow,
yeah.
Okay, good for you.
No.
I'm going to...
I'm still thinking.
I'm going to say Verstappen to beat Ricciardo across the season. I don't know how crazy that is. Does that count as crazy?
No, that's not crazy.
That's
enough.
Not crazy enough.
That's
okay. Not crazy enough. I'm going to say Kimi to beat Seb across the season.
Still not crazy enough.
Really? But it's still not enough. Yeah. Oh. We want more.
Well, where's our crazy threshold here?
I think maybe it's
just look to your left.
Works Renault to get a podium. How about that?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
That's okay. Yeah.
And it's probably not that crazy. Sauber to beat McLaren in the Championship for Constructors.
Wow.
Good Lord.
Right. Well, there we go. We're going to be back at the end of the season. We're going to obviously review the whole season, but we've got loads of podcasts in between now and then. So thank you so much, Mark. Thank you, Simon. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Karun, so much for coming in. Thank you, Alan, as always, for recording all this.
You're going to have biscuits next time. I keep getting promised these biscuits every time I come to a podcast.
Did I promise them again and I didn't deliver?
Again.
Okay, I'll tell you what, when McLaren finishes on the podium, I'll send loads of biscuits over. Thank you so much for watching and thank you so much for listening. We'll see you all soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Some things are made to cope with puddles and rain. Others deal with the stickiest of mud. And as for the snow, that takes a warm coat and sure footing. But when it comes to dealing with all conditions, there's only one thing that springs to mind. Mercedes-Benz 4MATIC. All-wheel drive performance in any condition. So whatever the weather or road throws at you, you're ready. To see the 4MATIC range for yourself, visit your local Mercedes-Benz retailer.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.